If you want to get your Bibles and turn to John chapter 13, if you're just coming in, there are some handouts on that back table if you want to pick one of those up on your way in. John chapter 13 is a wonderful chapter. It's one of the more compelling stories in the life of Jesus about what happens in John 13. This is the only place in the New Testament that we read this particular story and this particular account of what happens in John 13, and yet it teaches us so much. And so what I want us to do is to briefly look at some vital concepts that come from this chapter, and then try to spend some time this morning looking at the theme and how John develops a particular theme in this chapter and uses it to help to teach us. So let me briefly go through some of these vital truths and concepts that I think are important for us to grab from this chapter. I don't know if we place enough emphasis. I know we understand it and we talk about it. I don't know if we place enough emphasis on the betrayal of Jesus. We think about His death and His burial and His resurrection, but what was it that was the catalyst? What was it that started all of that into motion? It was the betrayal. You know, Jesus is in the upper room. Jesus goes to the Garden of Gethsemane. Jesus is praying in the Garden of Gethsemane. Jesus had been there frequently and praying there. But the thing that started these last hours of Jesus' life to go down this path of suffering, of punishment, of these scourgings, of these trials, and of the crucifixion, is the fact that Judas walked up and kissed Him. And so here in John 13, we don't have the betrayal, but we have Jesus predicting the betrayal. Jesus knew that His hour had come. We said last week that up until chapter 12, Jesus kept talking about the future, saying that His hour had not yet come, His time had not yet come. But you get to chapter 12, verse 23, the hour had come. Chapter 13, He knows His hour has come. And it's in verse 31, the first word that Jesus says. Judas leaves the upper room. Judas gets up from the Passover feast. He leaves as Jesus has told him to do. And the first word out of Jesus' mouth when Judas is gone is now. Now the Son of Man is glorified. There were these events that were starting to form and to take shape, and the very fact that Judas was getting ready to betray Him was that event that was going to set all of this into motion. Very sad occasion, obviously. But think about all that transpired because of that one kiss. Jesus was arrested, He was bound, He was put on in a series of mockeries of trials, He was beaten, He was scourged, He was hung on a cross, and it all started by one man betraying Him. What does that say about the power of your influence? That one act, as insignificant, small, in the whole scope of things as it might seem, that one act against our Lord can create a snowball effect that we ourselves may never witness. Did Judas witness all that transpired after his betrayal? He didn't. We may not ever know the impact that we have, but we need to be conscious of that influence that we have in our lives. Here's something big that we see in chapter 13, and that's the work of Satan. Look in chapter 13. We saw verse 1 for just a minute, that Jesus knew that His hour had come. It was time for Him to depart. Look in verse 2. The supper was in progress. It was not it was not the end. It was during this supper. Verse 2 says, the devil had already put into the heart of Judas to betray Jesus. Now, how did the devil get that in there? How does the devil get into anyone's heart? What'd you say, Nicole? You let him in. Who said something over here?
Open.
Say again.
Open.
You've got to open, don't you? Will God force himself upon you? No, you got to let him in. Will Satan, can Satan force you to do something against your will? No, he cannot. You have to open your heart. You have to let him in. So verse 2 says that the devil had already put into Judas's heart to betray him. When did that start? Was it just right here in John 13? Had it just started? No. It had been going on. This was not the first time. You go back into the other gospel accounts, into Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and you see that Judas, do I have Luke 22 up here? That Judas had gone to the chief priest and had agreed with them to betray Jesus. What did it take? I mean, what was Judas's, you know, everybody, we say everybody has their price. What did it take for Judas to betray Jesus?
Money.
30 pieces of silver. Judas was a covetous man. Covetous. Money. Money meant more to him than anything else. Remember what we saw in the previous chapters about Judas, that he was the treasurer, that he was the one that carried. There's somebody who can deal with the distraction that's happening in the class. I would appreciate it because everybody's attention is on the distraction instead of what we're talking about this morning. That's not a reprimand for any of you. I'm just concerned about the distraction that we have in class. And if somebody can deal with that, that would be wonderful. So, here we have Judas, who as the treasurer was responsible for carrying the money box. And if he's carrying the money box, oh, he wants to fill that money box up. He loves money. So what was it that was going to get in his way of serving Jesus? What was going to get in his way of serving Jesus was money. Is that what he allowed to get in the way? So Judas agrees to betray Jesus for money. Is there something that could buy your faith? Is there a price that you have? Thank you, Johnny. Is there a price that you have? Is there a breaking point for you that at some point, because was Judas always against Jesus? Was he always one who had his heart against Jesus? Y'all with me? It's hard to be with me, isn't it? When Jesus selected the 12 apostles, you know who they are? Peter, Andrew, James, John. Y'all want to sing the song? Where was Judas's heart? Where was Judas's heart when Jesus selected him? Did he have a heart of betrayal? No. Did Jesus know Judas's heart when he selected him? Knew his heart. Did Jesus know that someone was going to betray him? Do you think he knew it was Judas? Did Judas have a good heart when Jesus selected him? Yeah. But over time, his heart grew distant from the Lord. Is it possible that your heart over time could draw distant from the Lord? Judas allowed something to get in the way. And Satan was more than willing to help him out. So Satan was the one, it's interesting, he had already put into the heart of Judas. Had Judas betrayed Jesus yet? That's a trick question. Had Judas betrayed Jesus yet? Well, drop down. He had already put it into his heart. He had already gone and agreed to accept the money. And so the time comes in verse 27 that Satan enters into his heart. I don't know if I've got, I guess I've got it on a later slide, where it talks about the fact that Judas was already betraying Jesus. That Jesus knew look down in verse 11. Here's where it is, and I've got it on a later slide. In verse 11, the Bible says, Jesus knew who would betray him. In our minds, we think the word betray there is in the future tense. We knew who would betray him in the future. The word betray there in verse 11 is in the present tense. What does that mean? He's already betraying him. How? He'd already been to the chief priest. He had already agreed to accept money. He had already been looking for Satan had put that into his heart. And we think, oh, he hadn't committed the big deed yet, so he hadn't sinned yet. What did Jesus say about adultery? Can you sin before you ever get to the point of committing adultery? If you lust in your heart. What about murder? Could you sin without ever committing? Could you go right up to the point of murder, and if you don't commit the act, you haven't sinned yet? No, Jesus says if you have hate for your brother in your heart, you've sinned. So what about betrayal? If he hadn't gone through with the kiss, if he hadn't identified him, maybe he hasn't sinned yet. No, he had been betraying him all along in his heart. And so finally, Satan enters him. The terminology that's used there before he gets up and he leaves. Verse 27, after the piece of bread, Satan enter into him. Satan works little by little to turn you away from God. He'll plant a seed here, he plants a seed here, he plants a seed here. What happens if you plant enough seeds? Something might eventually grow. Pat? Pat says that people think they can flirt with the devil and be okay, not get taken in. Can you play with fire and not get burned, or whatever other metaphors or examples we want to give? Kristen?
Bill chose to take that back.
Somebody that can be right there with Jesus, eyeball to eyeball, sitting with him, talking with him, listening to him, and still turn away from him. What does that say about the possibility of us doing it? Oh, that'll never happen to me. Do you think Judas ever thought that at some point? That'll never happen to me? Sure he did. What an amazing concept. What does this say about Satan? Is Satan afraid of attacking those who are closest to Jesus? Is anybody a foregone conclusion? Oh, they're out of my reach. I'll just leave them alone from now on. Did Satan leave Jesus alone? If he tempted the Son of God, do you think he's afraid of you? Now, is he afraid of God? Who's more powerful, Satan or God? If we trust in God, what does God promise us regarding Satan? Can we overcome him? Yes. Can we find the way of escape? Yes. If Jesus was victorious, all this discussion about Satan might get us down, but if Jesus was victorious over Satan, if Jesus conquered death, if Jesus conquered the power of sin to provide us salvation, what does that say about us and Satan? He who is in us is greater than he who is in the world. Another vital concept regarding Satan is down in verse 30, where it says, it's interesting that John says that it was night when Judas went out. Obviously, that's a point of reference as to the time of day. But I think it's interesting symbolically what was happening in the life of Judas. It wasn't light anymore in the life of Judas. Judas was now walking in darkness. Dave? Yeah. It is a constant battle. And even the Apostle Paul in 1 Corinthians chapter 9 and verse 27 talked about the fact that he needed to bring his own body. The Apostle Paul said, I've got to bring my own body into subjection, lest while I go out and preach to others, I myself become condemned because of sin or my own neglect. couple more truths, and then I want us to get to this theme. We see that the blessings of God are conditional. And just look at the word if in that verse, in verse 17, where it says the only way that we receive the blessings of God is if we do what God says. It's conditional. But I think we also see in this chapter something we've seen in several other chapters, and that is that Jesus knows you probably even better than you know yourself. Did Jesus know that Judas was going to betray him? Did Judas know that? I mean, when they went to the upper room, they're all seated around this table. Do you think that Judas still thought that he was hiding this from the Lord? That Jesus still, he still didn't know. Did the apostles know? They didn't have a clue, even after Judas left. Jesus says, go and what you do quickly in verse 28. No one at the table knew for what reason he said that to him. Even the apostles are clueless. Judas has got the apostles snowed on this. What about Jesus? Does he think he's got Jesus snowed? Well, he might think it. But Jesus knew what Judas was planning to do, even though Judas thought he was hiding it. Can we hide anything from God? Yes, ma'am. Well, we don't know what Judas thought was going to happen. Sometimes we don't always think all the way down the road as to what's going to transpire based upon our actions, especially when it comes to the matter of covetousness. You know, when it comes to me and money, you know what I'm concerned about? Me and money. How that impacts somebody else, I may not care. What that means in the long term, I may not care. How strong is the love of money? Let's see. Paul says the love of money, not money itself, but the love of money is the root of all kinds of evil. Starts there. And where it spreads, if it's the root, whatever grows out of that, boy, it can be all kinds of stuff. Richard? Yeah. But that's part of the deception. We don't have it here in John's account, but when Jesus says, go back up to verse, where is this? Go back up to verse 21. Verse 21, Jesus, troubled in spirit, testified and said, most surely I say to you, one of you will betray me. Verse 22. Then the disciples looked at one another. Now I want you to imagine Judas sitting there. Then the disciples looked at one another, perplexed about what he spoke. Now, in John's account, it's Peter who signals to John, says, hey, ask him who he's talking about. But Richard's right. When you go over and you read other accounts, Matthew 26 says that all of the apostles began saying, Lord, is it I? Lord, is it I? Lord, is it I? You know who that includes? Judas. So in this whole matter of deception, he's still pulling the wool over. Is it me? Oh, it's not me, is it? All the while knowing it was him. Your children never did that, did they? I mean, just act innocent. Act like, oh, you're not me, is it? And you were fooled, right? You thought, oh, they're so innocent and perfect, it can't be them. You think Jesus was fooled? I don't think so. Here's the power of Satan, but here's the love of Jesus. Jesus knew Judas was going to do this. Jesus knew Peter was going to deny him before Peter ever knew he was going to deny him. You look at the end of chapter in verse 37, and Peter says, Lord, why can I not follow you now? I will lay down my life for your sake. Lord, I'll do whatever it takes. Will you lay down your life for my sake? Verse 38, most assuredly I say to you, the rooster shall not crow till you have denied me three times. Was that the farthest thing from Peter's mind? I'm going to deny you? Don't think so. Not going to happen. Jesus knows us, perhaps even better than we know ourselves. Let's look at a theme for chapter 13, and it was hard to boil it down into one concept, so I've got three here. But what is chapter 13 all about? It's about love, humility, and greatness. When it comes to love and humility and greatness, Can any of those exist without the other? Biblically speaking, scripturally speaking, can love, humility, and greatness, can any of those exist without the other? Look in chapter 13, look in verse 1. Before the feast of the Passover, when Jesus knew that His hour had come, that He should depart from this world to the Father, and then these interesting statements, having loved His own, His apostles, having loved His own who were in the world, He loved them to the end. What does that mean? He loved them to the end. Okay? He's going to finish it. He's going to finish it. He loved them to the end. What does it mean when you say to someone or about someone, I love you with all of my heart? What does that mean? Okay? Unto death? Is there anything that's going to get in the way of that love? Is there anything that's going to impede that love? When it comes to the love of Jesus, His love is unparalleled. There is nothing like it in all of the earth. When it comes to the love of Jesus, His love was not affected by the failure or the unworthiness of the people He loved. Did Judas deserve His love? Did Peter deserve His love? How many times did good old impetuous Peter let his mouth get him in trouble? How often when Peter gets out and starts walking on the water and takes his eyes off of Jesus, how often, figuratively and literally, did Jesus have to pick Peter up and get him back on the right path? At some point, would the average person have gotten tired of Peter and his problems and his failures? Did Jesus? No. He loved him. How much did He love him? He loved him to the very end. He did that with Peter. He did that with Judas. And unlike the other, unlike the Jews who He told back in chapter 7 and chapter 8 that they were not going to go to heaven because of their rebellious, stubborn spirit, He tells the apostles they can go. They get confused about it. Look at verse 33. Jesus says, little children, I shall be with you. Remember, he's in the upper room. Put this in the context. He's in the upper room. It's Jesus and His apostles. That's it. Little children, I shall be with you a little while longer. You will seek me. And as I said to the Jews, where I am going, you cannot come. Chapter 7, 34 and 8, 21. So now I say to you. Peter was a little confused by that. Verse 36, he says, Lord, where are you going? Jesus said, where I am going, you cannot follow me. And when He was talking to the Jews, He said, you cannot follow me, period. Where I'm going, you cannot, period, come. That's it. You're not going to be able to come. But Jesus puts an extra word in there. Do I have it up here? You cannot follow me now. Does that mean they could follow Him later? Well, that's what He says. You cannot follow me now, but you shall follow me afterward. He told the Jews, these religious leaders who had hardened their hearts against Him, He said, you're not going to go to heaven. But He turns to His apostles and He says, you're not going to go to heaven now, but you will. Why wouldn't Jesus let His apostles go with Him? They had work to do. They were his ambassadors to take the gospel to the world. He said, you cannot go with me now. The time will come that you can come with me. But right now I have work for you to do. Jesus loved His apostles. He loves those who serve Him and promises them a home with Him in heaven. But I want you to think about how the disciples responded to the love of Jesus. Over and over throughout several times throughout the gospel accounts, you find the apostles arguing about who was the greatest. And you find the apostles arguing about who was going to be the greatest in the kingdom. What did James and John ask? What did their mother ask of Jesus? Lord, when your kingdom comes, let us sit, one on your left hand and one on your right hand. What was the problem? Were they hard of hearing? Did they need to sit close to him so that they could hear what he was saying? Why did they want to sit one on this side and one on that side? Sign of power and authority. No, I'm not two or three down from Jesus. I'm number one. That's what they wanted. That's what they asked for. They disputed and argued about greatness on multiple occasions. And the first time we read about it in chapter 18, Jesus took a child. Think about this. Here are these grown men arguing about who's the greatest, and Jesus takes a child, plops the child down right there in front of them. Object lesson. Learn the lesson. Did they learn it? No. Two chapters later in Matthew, one chapter later in Mark, they do it all over again. Flip back to Luke chapter 22 for a second. We're going to come right back to John chapter 13. But come to Luke chapter 22. Start in the first part of the chapter so you can see the parallel between Luke 22 and John 13. Luke 22 verse 1. Now the feast of unleavened bread drew near, which is called Passover. And the chief priests and the scribes sought how they might kill Jesus, for they feared the people. Verse 3 of Luke 22. Then Satan entered Judas, surnamed Iscariot, who was numbered among the 12. So he went his way, Judas did, and conferred with the chief priests and captains how he might betray him to them. And they were glad and agreed to give him money, so he promised and sought opportunity to betray him to them in the absence of the multitude. Then came the day of unleavened bread, when the Passover must be killed. He sent Peter and John and said, "Go prepare the Passover for us that we may eat." And so Peter and John go, verse 13, they found the room just as Jesus said it would be, and they prepared the Passover. So now they're in the upper room, Jesus and apostles, same context, same setting as we have in John 13. Drop down to verse 24, Luke 22, verse 24. Where are they? They're in the upper room. We call it the Last Supper. We look at it as the last opportunity Jesus and apostles are together before the trials and the crucifixion. Verse 24. Now there was also a dispute among the apostles as to which of them should be considered what? The greatest. Hello? They did it once. Jesus put a child right there. Hello, object lesson. They did it again, and then they tried to hide. The second time they tried to hide it from Jesus. That they were having this discussion. They didn't want Jesus to know about it. Then here they are in the upper room. Jesus is less than 24 hours from being dead. And what are they talking about? You the greatest? No, I'm the greatest. Are you? No, you're number two. I'm number one. Because I'm sitting. When they gathered around the table to sit, can you imagine them arguing who got to sit next to Jesus? Move over, Peter. He said, "Get behind me, Satan." So you get behind him. I'm going to sit right next to him. Can you imagine them arguing? They're in the upper room arguing about who's the greatest. Yeah. When the soldiers came, they ran. They were just getting some exercise, I think, Chuck. But when the soldiers came, they took off. The cowards. But here they are arguing about who's the greatest. They're in the upper room. And so when you read John chapter 13, come back over to this chapter. When you read John chapter 13, keep that context in mind. The constant disputing among the apostles about who's the greatest. And even right here on this occasion in the upper room, who's the greatest? Come back to John chapter 13. Verse 3. Jesus, knowing that the Father had given all things into his hand, and knowing that he had come from God and that he was going back to God. What did Jesus know about himself? Did Jesus know his divine nature, that he was of God? Did he know his divine mission? Did he know his divine power? Was there anybody greater than Jesus? Anybody? Did Jesus know that? Yes. In that room, in that upper room, who's the greatest person in that room? Is there any question about who the... Here they are arguing. Who's the greatest? You know, it's like Jay and I, you know, sitting in a room with Michael Jordan and arguing, you know, who's the best basketball player? Well, you know, between me and Jay, it probably doesn't matter, does it? If we're in the presence of greatness. Here are these apostles. Well, who's the greatest? Here's Jesus. Hello. Remember that child? Object lesson. What does Jesus do in verse 4? He got up. They were gathered around the table. He rose from supper. They were in a traditional reclined position, not in chairs, but reclined on their side and eating. He laid aside his outer garments. He took a towel and he girded himself with the towel. You got the picture? The greatest man, not just in the room, but in the world, gets up while these guys are talking about who the greatest is, and he walked over and he picked up a towel and he girded himself. They've come to this upper room. Traditionally, in that day, there would be a host. If you go to somebody's house, they're the host. And when you arrive at that house, the host or someone he has designated, a servant, would be responsible for washing the people's feet. What did they wear on their feet? They wore sandals. What kind of roads did they have? Did they pay high government money to have nice paved roads? Good old dirty, dusty roads. They get to these homes. Were their bodies clean? Yeah, their bodies were clean. Verse 10, Jesus says your bodies are clean. It's your feet that need to be washed. Well, they got to this upper room and there was no host for this particular occasion. It's just Jesus and his apostles. And none of the apostles had volunteered to do the host duties because that involved washing feet. And we're more concerned about deciding who is the greatest than we are with stooping down and washing somebody's feet. So nobody else had done it. Jesus rose from supper, took a towel. Jesus girded himself. It's interesting when you back up into verse 3 and it says, Jesus knew that all things had been given into his hands. What does he take into his hands on this occasion? A towel and a basin of water. I want you to get this picture. That you are sitting there and you're eating. Jesus gets up. Where's he going? What's he doing? Jesus gets up. You know, does he need to, you know, does he need to stretch his leg? He gets up. He walks up. He's taking his outer garment off. He's putting a towel. He's getting a basin. What? What is he doing? Do any of them jump up and say, no, sit down, I'll do that. We don't have any record of them doing that. After that, verse 5, he poured water into a basin and began to wash the dirt and the grime off of their feet. Is there any more menial task on this occasion than washing their feet? Who's the greatest one in the room? Jesus. Who's the one washing feet? Jesus. Poured water into a basin, began to wash the disciples' feet and to wipe them. You see that? Got the picture? Wiped them with the towel which he girded himself. Came to Simon Peter. No, we don't know how many feet he had washed before he got to Simon Peter. Verse 6. Peter said to him, and the emphasis here is on the pronouns, Lord, are you washing my feet? Something's wrong with this picture. Yeah, you're right, Peter. Something is wrong with this picture. A lot. And you're part of what's wrong. Are you washing my feet? Kind of reminds you of John the Baptist's reaction when Jesus wanted him to baptize him, doesn't it? You're coming to me? I need to be baptized. You're washing my feet? Jesus says to him, if I do not... verse 7, what I am doing, you don't understand now, but you will after this. Peter says, you'll never wash my feet. Latter part of verse 8, if I don't wash you, you have no part with me. And so Peter's more than willing at that point. Okay, Lord, do the whole job. Can you imagine what it took for Jesus to wash Peter's feet after all he had done and all he would do? Can you imagine what it took for Jesus to stoop down and wash Judas's feet? You think when he got to Judas, he just washed the tops of his feet and said, you know what, I'm just going to leave the bottoms. You think that's what he did? Knowing Jesus, he probably did it a second time. Just to make sure he was thorough. That's surmising. The Bible doesn't say that. Do you think Jesus left the job half done because he was a little upset with Judas? The Bible says that Jesus washed their feet. He washed all of their feet. Every single one of them. There was no host there to do it. The disciples had not chosen to do it. The greatest one in the room stood up to go wash feet. And what an object lesson it was. Even greater than that child being put in their midst. Look down in verse 12. When he had washed their feet, taken back his outer garments, he sat down again. I got 1 minute. Verse 12. Do you know what I've done to you? Do you understand the significance of what I've done is what he's saying? You call me teacher and Lord. That's true, they did. He's Lord because he's the master. He has all authority. He's their teacher because he's the one that instructed them. Guess what Jesus was doing on this occasion? He was teaching them. Sometimes you teach with words and instructions, and sometimes you teach by example, don't you? Jesus says, I am your teacher and Lord. And I want you to see these words, because we're not going to have time to finish this. So I am, verse 14, if I then, your teacher and Lord, have washed your feet, you also ought to wash, just as I've done this, you also do it. Verse 15, I have given you an example that you should do as I have done to you. What was the example? Here's what I've done, and as I have done it, you come and you copy it. You pattern yourself after it. Now, jump over to verse 34. This was the example by which Jesus taught them, and now he teaches them by precept when we get into verse 34, where Jesus says, a new commandment I give you, that you should love one another, next three words, as I have. Those same as I have words are found when Jesus washes the feet. As I have done this, you do it. That's your pattern. That's your measuring rod. When it comes to loving one another, what does Jesus say? As I have loved you. There's your measuring rod. And the love in this chapter, we've summarized the chapter to say it's love, humility, and greatness. The love in this chapter cannot exist and cannot be expressed without humility. Loving one another is an act of humility. Putting their needs higher than our own. That's what Jesus taught his disciples, both in instruction and in example. And Jesus said, if the greatest one in the room can stoop down and wash your feet, verse 16, is the servant greater than the master? That's the only verse here where you got the word greater. Who's greater? The master's greater than the servant. But if the master serves, then you need to be just like your master. That's all we've got time for this morning. Take your handout, read through chapter 13, and grow to love what Jesus has done for us on that occasion. And may we follow his example as he would have us to do.